Welcome to the Spotlight Report, part of Erie Insights, a resource dedicated to discussions regarding optics and science. I'm your host, Logan Graves, at the University of Arizona. Our website is erieinsights.com, where you can find this episode and comment or subscribe. Additionally, you can find our other podcast series, as well as articles and other resources. Our email address is mail@erieinsights.com. We would love to hear from you. Okay, so this week we are sitting down with Dr. Hugh Choi, who is a postdoc in the Large Optics and Fabrication Testing Group at the University of Arizona. Dr. Choi has a background in astronomy and photonics and has spent extensive time on a variety of optics projects recently, so excited to sit down and talk with him. So Hugh, could you explain what project you're currently focused on?
This day, I am focused on a couple of projects. One is a couple of things are related to the industry. This one usually, actually, the industry people ask us very challenging methodology, especially some display and semiconductor. And the other one is I'm also working on the LBT, the Large Binocular Telescope. This telescope, yeah, usually very complicated, and then they want to clarify what kind of error is in. So I'm working on this, especially on collimation and pointing part.
And before we jump into that, can you just tell us a little bit of how you came about being on this project? So what was your background before you got into the LOP group at UVA?
It's a pretty long story, so actually. My major was just physics, not optics. And at the very first, my career, actually, I'm working on the nonlinear optics. I used the high-power laser, and then I shot the laser with for the some specific phenomena, such like once you shot the green on the crystal, that crystal actually can make some UV or blue light. That is just for the new radio material. Sometimes we use these risos for the new lithography fabrication. But for this, actually that lab needs a specific methodology such like the majorly refractive index or thickness of the crystal. That was my first step on the methodology. Then I continuously moved to the methodology such like measuring thickness, measuring distance. Then I got this some kind of experience on the interferometry. So, you know, interferometry is the one of the significant skill technique on the optical testing. Then my career just lead me in this situation, the all kind of the optical testing right now.
So interferometry being basically the bridge from not necessarily even small optics, but nonlinear optics, photonics a little bit to large optics, which is what you're working on now. And when we say large optics, we mean really, really large optics. So you mentioned that you work on the LBT project, the Large Binocular Telescope. For our listeners that are familiar, we'll put up a link to that. Can you explain, just first off, what is the LBT system? What is it used for?
LBT is a super nice, amazing telescope, and then largest telescope so far before the GMT. And the one primary mirror has the 1.4 meter diameter, and then these two prime mirrors just work like the binocular. So the
Let me take a step back. What's the diameter of the primary?
The 1.4 meter. 8.4 meter. Yeah, 1.4 meter is just like.
I was gonna say that's. Yeah. So 8.4 meter.
Yeah.
And that's enormous.
Yes, one primary mirror size.
Right, a single monolithic piece of glass.
Yes.
Okay.
And then the LBT has two, so the name is the binocular. And to work with these two primary mirror, actually we have to co-phaging these two. So without co-phaging, it is just the 8.4 meter telescope. Once you do that, actually we can get at least the 20 meter diameter, and then it provides us amazing the spatial resolution on our target. So, but you know, this kind of huge and large system always have some challenging, such like well collimation and pointing. So this system already have the adaptive optic system to compensate some kind of error. But the active optics, which I working on right now, is provide best condition before starting the adaptive optics. So active optics can fix the wavefront error maybe up to a few micron. But if you cannot see your star, actually the active optics cannot, adaptive optics cannot start their loop.
Right. So before we jump into that, actually, what do we look at with the LBT? Just to give context to our
discussion. All right.
Why do we, it's enormous, it's a great system, but why do we care? What do we see from it?
Oh, well, so to look at the very deep space, we need a really nice photon collector. So to get the single photon from the really deep space, we need a large optic such like 8.4 meter. So whenever you increase your primary meter, you can get many photons from the very far distance. So people try to make a large one. And also, if you increase the size of the meter, it meaning that you're gonna increase the resolution of your image system. So if you want to see really tiny area with many photons, the large of this necessary. So LBT do this project.
And we'll, when we link to the LBT, we'll include some of the science missions that they have.
Mm-hmm.
But you started talking about active and adaptive optics. So what's the difference?
Oh, yeah. Active optics is some kind of the preliminary alignment that people starting observatory. They do that every time people starting the observatory. Adaptive optics is some kind of the wavefront error compensation. The active optics, actually, they trying to find nice collimation and point. So we should very clear these two parts. But yeah, people starting the very complicated things. The hardware, actually, they mesh it up, they the very complicated system, and then some part works for the adaptive optics and also active optics as well. For the adaptive optics, we use the secondary mirror, which has 1,000 actuator with a few kilohertz response time. So you know the secondary mirror first surface is very thin glass, so you cannot poke one stroke more than maybe 2 millimeter. It's gonna be breakdown. So if you have that kind of the huge wavefront error or misalignment, actually, we have to change the position of the primary and secondary. Or you can change some pneumatic support under your primary mirror. Usually, this active optic speed is really slow. Even your closed loop, each closed loop take more than 7 or 8 minutes. But usually, these active optics take into account the thermal distortion of your primary mirror. Or the gravitational effect along the attitude or the status of your telescope. So the 8 or 7 minute the loop speed is good enough to compensate this error. But that is not everything, the active optics. So to work with these two primary mirror, these two primary mirror should look at the same point. So people call it that this is pointing. So if your two mirror look at the different point, eventually you cannot use these two mirror for the every single image. So to look at it the same point, you have to adjust the primary mirror angle. And also, you should find a very nice collimation condition for the all hardware position, such like your secondary and tertiary, everything.
Right, and it go and far beyond tertiary.
Oh, you're right.
How many mirrors are there in the LBT?
For the active optics, we can use the primary and secondary and tertiary. The beyond the tertiary inside instrument, they also has very complicated middle system. Yeah. But D3 is the prime target on the antibiotics right now.
And then, so let's assume that that I don't have any knowledge about telescopes. Mm. I think a lot of optical systems, people assemble them and they say, okay, I got my tolerances right. I put everything together.
Mm-hmm.
But so it should be in focus. I don't need to touch anything.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that there's gravitational sag. There can be thermal effects. And then pointing. So why do these things go out of focus, I guess, is my question.
Oh, why is out of focus? So main problem is when they change this elevation, the secondary mirror position can affect by the angle due to the gravitation, right?
Mm.
And also, this primary mirror has the gravitational sag itself.
Which changes
as
you tilt the telescope.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for listeners to remember, we're talking about multi-ton pieces of glass being supported.
20 tons, yeah.
Yeah, being 20 tons.
Yeah.
So being supported with, beams of steel, so certainly strong, but as you get a number of feet or tens of feet away, 20 tons along steel is going to bend the steel slightly.
Yes.
And all it takes is a few microns, you said?
Oh, let's say, yes. So maybe 20 micron or 10 microns easily change. But this kind of change can show up our image very quickly. So the ABT, each instrument has a wavefront sensor and the image evaluation system. So some system just use the taken the image to calculate the aberration. So while you are doing the calculation, actually you can pick up the how many aberrations is there, and then we can convert it into the hardware misalignment. It was
purely from wavefront sensor.
Yeah, but if you don't have nice star, and if you deviate far away from the nominal position, you cannot do this kind of calculation. For that, active optics prepare that kind of situation. So very first period of the observation, active optics do some kind of very brief collimation. Then some beam goes into the sensor. Then we can use this kind of the wavefront sensor and the image evaluation method.
Right. So effectively, active optics are doing a rough alignment.
Yes.
And rough alignment is very much so in context here because they're aligning them to within prongs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a very good alignment, but in the context of astronomy, it's rough.
Mm-hmm.
And you use everything, use active optics to get the primary mirrors, the secondary, and even possibly the tertiary mirrors into the correct position so that adaptive optics can take.
Right.
And the one last thing that you mentioned is that this is ongoing. So every 8 minutes, the active optics are repeating the alignment to make sure everything's aligned. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We'll come back to that. But once it's in alignment, what is adaptive optics?
What is adaptive optics? The adaptive optics. Once we finish it. Active optics, people say that now we got the singing limit. The singing limit meaning that we have the perfect alignment of the hardware. And then somehow the air or some wind can affect to our wavefront. Then that's the kind of the wind, actually we cannot fix it if we don't have an active optics. Active optics just do the compensate is the very fast but very small wavefront error. So usually it came from the wind. The top of the mountain, we have the strong wind, especially close to up to the 30 meter. Over than 30 meter, we don't have that much very strong wind. So mainly we compensate this very strong wind close to our telescope.
Basically turbulence. lines, right?
Yes. On top of the mountain. Right.
Which isn't terribly surprising because these things are placed, like you said, on top of mountains because it's good for seeing, but also, as we know, there's a lot of wind up on top of mountains.
Yes, and also the structure, the building shape also can affect to the turbulence. So we just open the one side, and then if you have the wind just in front of the our side, it makes a very unexpected wind flowing. Mm-hmm. So we opened the other side to make the kind of the expectable wind flow. Mm-hmm. And so the design, the dome design, this structure design also a very important part to have the very stable air flow close to the telescope. Yeah. And plus, the active objects always need their reference star. So, and if you don't have the reference star nearby your target, so you have to make your artificial star. So IPT use the laser to make this artificial star, and then the system name is the Argos. So Argos use the powerful laser to make the artificial star, and we know the star shape. And then if you see that something that distorts this artificial star in your image, then we can do the active optics to compensate, to have the non-shape on our image surface.
So again, for people who aren't in astronomy, I think that the statement, you're making a star with a laser.
Yeah.
What does that mean for someone who's not in astronomy or astronomical optics?
Because
you're basically projecting a well-known, powerful laser.
Yes, this laser hit some radio on the atmosphere. And then it makes very strong scatter at the layer. So without scatter, actually laser just go through the space.
It would just shine out.
Yes, but once it hit this laser, that layer, and then we can see the something scatter right. Image, and then it can be our reference star for the adaptive optics.
So it's basically like if I'm inside and I shined a laser pointer onto a wall,
mm-hmm.
and I said I know the laser pointer really well, I know where the wall is, then I know what the shape should be of that laser.
Yeah.
But I take an image of that shape that scatters back, and then based off of how dissimilar it is from what it should be,
mm-hmm.
I can say, okay, this is, I can determine the alignment that I now need to. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have so that's how you align the active optics. And then once that's aligned, the adaptive optics kick into play. Do they also use the Argos laser?
Yes, if you don't have your nice star, nature star nearby your target, yeah. And one of the good thing of the laser system is actually this laser system use our optics. So you can make your reference star at the on axis.
Oh, okay. Right. So it's almost preferable to make a reference star.
So yeah, if your star at the off axis from your target, actually you have to take into account this opposite effect as well.
Mm.
But if you can make this artificial star on axis, then it's beautiful. So right. That is so easy. But
and it kind of limits some of the unknowns.
Yeah.
And this is where you get the really cool pictures of it looks like because it is just a giant laser beaming out from these observatories.
Actually this telescope can see the beam of this actually they only can see the scatter the light, but that video actually show us really nice kind of the light beam is
computer generated. Yeah.
Our long exposure give us this. Yeah.
Sure. That makes sense. Mm. So you get that beam back and it hits a wavefront sensor and that gives you a lot of information about turbulence in the atmosphere, right?
Mm-hmm.
With that information, that's how you guide the adaptive optics. So can you talk about, you alluded to it earlier, that the adaptive optics are pushing on glass.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about kind of how many piston points or pushing points there are in the adaptive optics and how fast it is. Because it's faster than the active optics, right?
Yeah. The secondary adaptive optics has the 1,000 actuator behind the very thin glass. And
how big is the secondary?
Sorry. Secondary is almost this size.
Okay, so maybe a meter?
Yes, half meter. Yeah.
So 1,000 pushing points behind a half meter.
Yeah.
So very dense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the speed of the adaptive optics is the 1 kilohertz. So it's super fast.
Right.
And you know, you have the experience on the adaptive optics, and it always takes one loop because they do the very complicated calculation. But this system doesn't use that kind of the very long calculation. They just convert certain intensity on the CCD to the actuator motion on the adaptive optics certain the actuator. Yes, it's pretty fast system. And then actually they can cover all kind of the air turbulence during right. the night. But you know, this hardware system derived from their nominal collimation condition, such like, so at the very first your observation, your collimation is perfect. But while you are turning on your adaptive optics, you're gonna see some tilt or some coma and astigmatism gonna increase, and then at a certain point you cannot compensate this with your adaptive optics. Then the arbitrator system give the signal to the active optics. Now we hit the limit of the adaptive optics. You have to fix this. Then the adaptive optics move slowly with 8 minutes.
Right.
Then adaptive optics can have some room, to compensate it.
And that makes perfect sense. It's like you're saying, there's certainly going to be a limit to how much you can push on glass to correct everything. So the adaptive optics, super fast, nonstop, is correcting turbulence.
Yeah.
In the air, because whatever you're imaging through space has to go through this constantly changing turbulent atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's mirroring the shape, the inverse shape on that secondary, right? But then at the same time, all of your optics and where you're looking is all moving.
Yeah.
Gravity, thermal effects, etc. And that's what the active optics are more slowly compensating.
Mm-hmm.
So does it work well?
Oh, that was our challenging right now. So in most cases, it works well because we have the nice lookup table at a certain elevation and temperature, and it works pretty well. But you know, this lookup table is how can I say that cannot cover the all situation. It doesn't meaning that the low sampling of the lookup table. So even you have the fully covered lookup table, such like the every 0.001 degree Celsius degree change temperature versus the wavefront of your primary, is kind of the very ideal situation. But sometimes we can see very challenging situations, such like the if we have to work with a very complicated instrument, the wavefront actually doesn't tell us primary only. We can see the comprehensive error just through everything. Sometimes it's over than 10 and 12. Over than 10 optics, we can see the something aberration, and then this lookup table actually just let us know, this wavefront error probably came from the primary, this kind of the temperature, but it can be not true. So sometimes it give us some long overshooting of the compensation. So to separate this kind of to decompose this kind of complicated information, we are going to use a certain method, such like the laser thrust. So we're going to use the laser system to measure the mechanical distance between the primary and secondary. So actually the GMT people want to use this system. You know, the GMT need the very complicated co-phaging. And also they has the separated secondary mirror for the each secondary, and then it's super extremely complicated system for the optical engineering. So for that, they wanted to use the laser truss, such like you can imagine the hexapod. So if you have the six axes, you can define surface versus your original position. So if we have the six laser line to look at the secondary 3 point, and then if you measure the these six distance, theoretically you can put the secondary mirror at the right. Nice position. During this kind of the test, actually, you don't need to start. You don't need to light. Just the laser system, which can measure the absolute distance, is the good enough to this. So people call it that this one is TMS, telescope metrology system. Basically, this idea just brought up by the Andrew Lakis. So he was the engineer in the MBT, and then currently he working for the GMT. So when he was in the LBT, he brought up this idea, and then the GMT people wanted to use this idea on the LBT first before buying the really large system for the GMT.
Before going all in for the big one. So this is, I like this for two reasons. One, that's fundamentally an interferometry, right? It's basically based on the idea that a coherent light source, you send it a distance, it hits something. Either it hits something and is recorded, or it hits something ideally and bounces back. You can tell the distance extremely well, to within nanometers or 7 nanometers from the system. And from what I recall about the GMT, they basically put these on the mirrors, so between the primary and secondary, but also between the secondary segments and primary segments, and you can tell where everything is, again, extremely precisely. What I really like about it is that the whole thing sounds really complicated, because it is. There's a lot of things going on, but it I always like it because my girlfriend's a math teacher for middle schoolers, and sometimes I've talked to him and I say, well, I don't know when I'm ever going to use math again. This is it's really an extreme example, but basically it's like algebra. You have too many unknowns, so how do you cut down on the unknowns? You get back a report from your wavefront sensing system that says there's this much wavefront error. And you don't know if it's truly the primary, if it's the secondary, if it's some combination, etc. So by attaching these distance measuring devices, you can start to isolate exactly what this scenario is.
So this mechanical position information provides us at least one very clear information about the distance between the primary and secondary. And then, just using the DIS, we can decompose it many parts, just synchronously, dependent. So if these two, the optical surface vortex doesn't have any dependent, but we can see the strong dependent, it meaning that on follow, some optics make that, not our system. So, or the, it also can provide very initial, the telescope alignment, such like people turn on the laser system, people open the dome. We can prepare this alignment before starting the Lear star observation. So, the telescope night is pretty expensive. The scientists pay a lot of money for that. So if we spend too much long time to get a nice collimation pointing, it meaning that it's not good for them. And also, it can be harmful for the LBT reputation. So people understanding the LBT is really complicated system, and they need some warm-up time. But if we can do the kind of warm-up very quickly, people love this system. And also, currently we have the various wavefront error measurement system for each instrument, and then this too complicated, and then it doesn't really easy to explain all the scientists and astronomer like that. So we want to make them much simplify this process than the understanding all people in the ABT or ABT related people. Then it's going to be nice for their understanding and also the ABT reputation.
So how do you simplify?
Simplify is, you know, the ABT has the amazing engineer and then they work on their specific project. But it's not easy to gathering all their information in the single one. But the active optics actually kind of stuff, such like the active optics people have to understand the hardware, such like the position of the swing arm for the, of the each tertiary and secondary. At the same time, we have to understand the what kind of aberrations came from the disc. And then if you understand where on the adaptive optics or waveform sensor as well, then you can talk about this kind of issue with adaptive optics people, such like probably you're gonna see this kind of aberration due to this hardware situation, not the secondary mirror shape like that. So once we make the gathering all this kind of the knowledge as just a well collimation and pointing, not active optics do the active job, or adaptive optics do the adaptive job. So once we combine the every disc knowledge as a single item, such like the collimation, then the people can understand that, yes, this is not collimation situation, or this is a well collimation situation. The detail is the active and adaptive optics do the working well, and then
like this. They don't need to know all the details. They don't need to know, okay, what's every piston in the adaptive optic system doing, and what's the hexapod, I don't know if there's a hexapod in the adaptive optics, but what that's doing. They just care, is it collimated, is it not collimated?
Yeah.
If it's not, get it collimated, right?
Yes. The scientists, the telescope operation should know everything, and then they already know well about this system, but just the single people cannot explain every time and every scientist. So.
Yeah, I'm not saying it in the sense for, you know, for our listeners. I'm not saying it like, oh, well, they just don't know and it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm sure that they're curious, but like you said, there's one LBT system.
Mm-hmm.
It's limited number of nights that it has a clear sky to image stuff. And there's people from around the world that tap into the LBT to take images. So it's essential that when you can get images, it's getting good images. Or data, you know, whatever it needs to be. They don't need to be wasting time on that.
Right.
Okay, let me dig into details. So can you comment on how you improve that, or what could be done to improve that that scenario?
Yeah. I have a couple of ideas to want to apply on the ABT system these days. So one is I told you the lookup table. Table is just kind of the 2D lookup table. So one axis is the point stance temperature. The other axis is wave rotator like that. Actually, they measure the temperature on 2D of the primary mirror. But this is some kind of the one dimension information. I wanted to increase this dimension, two or three dimension, to take into account the all kind of situation. So such like the, it's a really complicated matrix, right? But if you find a certain situation in the 3D point on your 3D the lookup table, it can well cover the situation. For that, maybe we can use the artificial intelligence or machine learning. So this machine learning can record. Actually, LBT have a lot of the log information during the last 10 years. If we use this information for the machine learning, basically, we're gonna have the amazing data set for the future work. So, I'd like to use this machine learning for this lookup table improvement. The other one is laser thrust. So, this project working with the GMT, and then we can install the laser probe to measure the distance the nearby the mirror. It doesn't mean that this is mirror surface. So we have to calibrate this system. For that, I'd like to develop very nice mount two key mechanical points of this laser probe, the same as the laser at the mirror surface, then the just distance information just give us the
range.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, there is many ideas under this, but this system is the real one. So we cannot test. Oh, I need some time to test my one. So no one
right.
allow me to the test. So probably at the very first step is make my method, and then the cross check with the real situation, such like the laser, the telescope operator decides to apply the certain compensation. Then maybe our machine learning program makes some tail result and then make a comparison. And then if we have confidence with this rate data over then 1 year, then we can suggest that yes, during the last 1 year, we have the almost same decision with human, and then we can use this decision with AI like that. So, this is my future.
So, if you don't mind, I'm always excited, but also a little bit, not necessarily skeptical, but I don't know, there are certain things with AI worrying about. So,
mm-hmm.
not in the traditional sense yeah. of like, oh no, it's going to take over. But machine learning, basically what you just said, you said that LBT has a vast log of data.
Mm-hmm.
So typically what you do is you give the data to the machine learning system or algorithm and train it on that data.
Yeah.
And then basically it does learned pattern matching.
All right.
Somewhat fundamentally, you know.
Yeah.
So this can work really well in scenarios where you're confident that you're not going to see something really new, mm-hmm. really different. Is that the case in the LBT?
Yeah, one problem is in the real world, people really not, how can I say that, not trust that this kind of the machine learning, and they always leave the human decision part because they need someone who is in charge on the very final result. So, but so far the LBT has the really nice scientists, and then that scientists understand everything, and then the decision is always right. But it takes time, and then actually some single step is doesn't necessarily to the make the decision. So maybe we can replace this kind of hazard task, and then we just give the very final output to make the very nice decision. So I thought that this kind of the AI or machine learning is powerful in the too many input situation. So if you have to make some decision with the 20 or 30 input, people have very nice sense, such like, yeah, this weapons looks like the power or astigmatism a little bit, and then let's apply the 70 micron like that. But if we have to train the new people, we have to spend almost the same time with our previous training. But if we have this machine learning support, new people also can make decisions very quickly. And only that people is in charge of the very final result.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Tesla car, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like it does everything, but someone has to sit in the driver's seat at right. the end of the day and override it if they do.
Mm-hmm. And also, some small auto battery system, such like the VATT or other small auto battery system, is not easy to stay too long time for the people. So if we can do this kind of the small the telescope, kind of make it kind of the autonomous telescope, then we can extend the possibility or capability of this telescope a lot.
Right.
But even you just think of even just a 1 meter telescope always need human people power because they have to make the collimation, and then this collimation or the really hard job need human experience. So it's not that much very difficult, but it's not easy to make this all kind of process automatically. So, you know, the alignment always need our touch, and then some nice systems can do the alignment very quickly, but this is not some kind of the autofocus system.
Right.
Yeah.
There's not like an absolute kind of you dial it in around and around and then you say like, okay, land it on the
right. Yeah. In some kind of, we have to find nice spot in the 3D. And then there are some local minima there, so we can easily drop to some other point. But if you have experience, you can escape very quickly. But right. If you don't,
think you're in the right.
Yeah.
This is, we'll link to it. I'll be sure to put this when we post it. But there's another podcast that I recently listened to who was talking to an economist. He's talking to the idea of gut feeling. And basically that humans are actually really smart when it comes to gut feeling. So like you're saying, you could train a computer system and hammer away and it might end up in a logo mode and think like, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
It doesn't think, it just says, okay, I've achieved a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Good to go. Whereas someone with experience would say like, oh no, I've seen this before. Actually, we have to do a little bit more. But yeah, anyways, I'll be sure. So these are both the lookup table and the
laser truss.
Laser truss.
Yeah.
Those are both being implemented, or are they already implemented?
Not yet. The laser truss is we are working on, and then currently we are developing. And the lookup table, the machine learning, is just our idea. And then we just gathering all the information and look at this log right now. And you know, there are a lot of the machine learning models, and then we are thinking about what kind of model is really works well. This is not an image calculation. This one is just parameters, but some complicated. And then, you know, sometimes people make very weird decisions when I look at this log, but it works well.
Right.
And when I look at the detail, actually, they are considering very certain the weather condition or the instruments condition. So this kind of stuff, meaning that this log has maybe 10 or 20 input, but eventually we need 50 or 100 input to make the same decision. So I don't want to really replace all the job position with the machine, but if we can save some time and if we can give some much each.
Right.
Yeah.
So the scenarios that you see, for example, maybe it's, you said temperature, having a 3D temperature map across the air, knowing the local wind, I'm sure, knowing seismic activity, I would imagine is important. There's probably not a whole lot of where the LVT is, but you have to know that pretty well. What are the other like key inputs to you said in the log there's 20, but like what are
the key factor is the a lot. So let's one of my in head is the elevation, so where do you look at it? And the other one is how opaque is you are look at it. So actually our parameter can cover almost 5 times size of the moon on the sky.
In a single
viewing. Yeah.
Okay.
So if you look at the Andromeda, actually is almost, I guess, twice larger than the moon. So actually we cannot see because it's too dim, but
if
you do the very long exposure, you're gonna see huge Andromeda shape on the sky. Meaning that this LVT can see the really large field. So it's this aberration is really rely on this field as well. The field and then elevation and humidity makes some kind of the maybe index change, and also each instrument also different, such like the mode, one of the spectrometer is placed just behind of the primary, and then the LBT interferometer placed between these two primary meter. So whenever you add the 30 or remove the 30 meter, it gives you different mechanical drift of the optical system. So the combination of your optics, such like we can use the primary and the camera only to cover the wide field, or you can use the primary and secondary to work with your spectroscope. Also, you can add primary, secondary, and tertiary. All these situations makes the much complicated input. And then this all input is different for the hour elevation and temperature. So sometimes some vibration is also matter. So if you do have to do the interferometer, the vibration is really matter. But, you know, to keep the temperature inside this dome, they use the air conditioner. Air conditioner have the pump. And then basically they always make the pump there. So they want to remove this. And one of the huge parts under this mechanical engineering of the LVT is the mitigating the vibration. So, and this vibration or what kind of motor is right now turned on also can be one of the parameters of this. So there is a lot, but you know, the once we just count this input, there is too many stuff. But human or well-trained machine learning easily can pick up the which one is key part and then make the decision very efficiently. So LVT people really think about the really nice, how can I say, nice knowledge transpiration, because there is a lot of the transition and people come and people out, and then they cannot spend 2 or 3 months to just training people. So well documenting can cover the when the reduce the training time, but if we make a simple system or easy system using this kind of a technology, then actually they don't need that much very long the training. Right. They just need the knowledge about the why it makes this decision. But they don't need to training really about that or how we can lead this parameter like that.
So we're pretty close to the hour, and I'd like to close on maybe 2 topics. When do you see these improvements going into place? And also, what do you see as the future for astronomical objects? Like what can we expect to see come up?
Oh, well, I love this kind of future stories, the future talking. So one of my peer, the Stuart, suggests the balloon type telescope. So they already have one, the Red Bull. But, you know, the large size optics is essential for the astronomy. And then monolithic primary mirror cannot be over than the 2 meters. If you think about the space project, it's too expensive. So this day people think about how we can make the large without that kind of monolithic the glass mirror. So the balloon, especially the mylar, can be the kind of the mirror. You just bring your birthday balloon on the space, then you can use this as a telescope, 1 million telescope.
Right.
So.
And you can make it really big.
Yeah, and also this surface is really close to the optical surface. So if you make the very nice some following optics, actually you just using the balloon as your primary mirror. And the other thing is, well segmented, but easy to co-phasing one. Mirror is not easy to co-phasing. But lens is much easier. Lens has a lot of tolerance more than the mirror. So if you can design lens telescope, so you know, but we just can cover the very certain range, but it doesn't need really nice collimation or calibrating system, nice the tolerancing. Also, the segmented one. Segmented, the small piece lens is easy to fabricate than the one large single monolithic mirror. So segmented lens and then this kind of the space balloon can be the future telescope.
And the segmented lens we've already seen, you alluded to the GMT, which is like 7-8 meter segments make it the primary mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So the net effect at the end of the day is that once it's assembled, the primary area will be within a basketball court.
Yeah.
And I was going to say field and soccer. And then we also have the 30-meter mirror and the European extremely large telescope, which both of which are using 1-meter hexagonal segments to achieve a really large primary
area. Yeah.
But, like you said, these are ground-based telescopes, and they're heavy. So the balloons I'm really excited about just because the sheer scope and then also getting it into space, you don't have to deal with atmospheric issues. You don't have to weather, et cetera.
That is one more thing. So, the last couple of decades, people just focus on the making powerful optical system. So it needs a lot of time and effort and money. But if we can specify our target, such as if you just want to explore the exoplanet, we can make the exoplanet telescope with just 10% money and effort. So the small set telescope can be the another option for the specific targeting. So our telescope doesn't need to have that much very complicated option capability. So if we can simplify or if we can targeting well on our system, we can make the small, cheap, and the much efficient one.
Right. And what can we expect to see? Like, what are the questions that these telescopes are answering? Why don't we just close on that? Because we're building, fantastic telescopes, but why do we care?
That is just for the curiosity, such like I thought that my PI, that they were always talking about this, the telescope is some kind of the time machine. So photon travel the time, then we always see the 8 minute before light from the sun. So if we can see much far away from our Earth, meaning that we can look at the history of the space. So if you look at the much, much deep space, meaning that we're not getting close to the Big Bang. So some people doesn't really care about, there is Big Bang. That's okay. Cool. But we really want to see the history with our eye, not just fossil like that. We can see the live space at the very last year.
Right.
Yeah, it's some kind of very exciting time machine building.
Right.
So
yeah, literally looking back into time to right to the first light after the Big Bang.
Yeah. Maybe it can be one of the, it can provide some kind of the energy solution like that. Tiny Big Bang makes the infinite energy like that. But even it just give us just one single image, actually for me that is good enough. Yeah.
Well, great. Our guest this week has been Dr. Kiju Choi. Kiju,
thank you for having me.
This has been the Spotlight Report. If you would like to comment or subscribe on today's episode or access more episodes of the Spotlight Report, please visit us at airyinsights.com, where you can comment and subscribe and additionally access other resources that we provide, such as alternative podcasts and articles, etc. Thank you for listening.